Chapter 16. Meanwhile, Kaiser kept daily importuning the Aedui for the corn which they had promised in the name of their state. For, in consequence of the coldness, Gaul being, as was said before, situated towards the north, not only was the corn in the fields not ripe, but there was not in store a sufficiently large quantity even of fodder. Besides, he was unable to use the corn which he had conveyed in ships up the river Seine, because the Helvetii, from whom he was unwilling to retire, had diverted their march from the Seine. The Aedui kept deferring from day to day, and saying that it was being collected, brought in, on the road. When he saw that he was put off too long, and that the day was close at hand on which he ought to serve out the corn to his soldiers, having called together their chiefs, of whom he had a great number in his camp, among them Divitiacus and Liscus, who was invested with the chief magistracy, whom the Aedui style as Vercobretus, and who is elected annually, and has power of life and death over his countrymen, he severely reprimands them, because he is not assisted by them on so urgent an occasion, when the enemy were so close at hand, and when corn could neither be bought nor taken from the fields, particularly as, in a great measure urged by their prayers, he had undertaken the war. Much more bitterly, therefore, does he complain of his being forsaken. Chapter 17. Then, at length, Liscus, moved by Kaiser's speech, discloses what he had hitherto kept secret, that there are some whose influence with the people is very great, who, through private men, have more power than the magistrates themselves, that these, by seditious and violent language, are deterring the populace from contributing the corn which they ought to supply, by telling them that, if they cannot any longer retain the supremacy of Gaul, it were better to submit to the government of Gauls than of Romans. Nor ought they to doubt that, if the Romans should overpower the Helvetii, they would wrest their freedom from the Aedui together with the remainder of Gaul. But these very men, said he, are our plans, and whatever is done in the camp disclosed to the enemy, that they should not be restrained by him. Nay more, he was well aware that, though compelled by necessity, he had disclosed the matter to Kaiser, as how great a risk he had done it, and for that reason he had been silent as long as he could. Chapter 18. Kaiser perceived that, in this speech of Liscus, Dumnorix, the brother of Divitiacus, was indicated. But, as he was unwilling that these matters should be discussed while so many were present, he speedily dismisses the council, but detains Liscus. He inquires from him alone about those things which he had said in the meeting. He, Liscus, speaks more unreservedly and boldly. He, Kaiser, makes inquiries on the same points privately of others, and discovers that it is all true, that Dumnorix is the person, a man of the highest daring, in great favor with the people on account of his liberality, a man eager for a revolution, that for a great many years he has been in the habit of contracting for the customs and all the other taxes of the Aedui at a small cost, because when he bids, no one dares to bid against him. By these means he has both increased his own private property and amassed great means for giving largesses, that he maintains constantly at his own expense and keeps about his own person a great number of cavalry, and that not only at home, but even among the neighboring states, he has great influence, and, for the sake of strengthening this influence, has given his mother in marriage among the Bituriges to a man the most noble and the most influential there, that he has himself taken a wife from among the Helvetii, and has given his sister by the mother's side and his female relations in marriage into other states, that he favors and wishes well to the Helvetii on account of their connection, and that he hates Kaiser and the Romans on his own account, because by their arrival his power was weakened, and his brother Divitiacus restored to his former position of influence and dignity. That, if anything should happen to the Romans, he entertains the highest hope of gaining the sovereignty by means of the Helvetii, but that under the government of the Roman people he despairs not only the royalty, but even of that influence which he already has. Kaiser discovered, too, on inquiring into the unsuccessful cavalry engagement which had taken place a few days before, that the commencement of that flight had been made by Dumnorix and his cavalry. For Dumnorix was in command of the cavalry which the Aedui had sent for aid to Kaiser, that by their flight the rest of the cavalry was dismayed. Chapter 19. After learning these circumstances, since to these suspicions the most unequivocal facts were added, viz. That he had led the Helvetii through the territories of the Sequani, that he had provided that hostages should be mutually given, that he had done all these things not only without any orders of his, Kaiser's, and of his own states, but even without their, the Aedui, knowing anything of it themselves, that he, Dumnorix, was reprimanded by the chief magistrate of the Aedui. He, Kaiser, considered that there was sufficient reason as why he should either punish him himself or order the state to do so. One thing, however, stood in the way of all this, that he had learned by experience his brother Divitiacus's very high regard for the Roman people, his great affection towards him, his distinguished faithfulness, justice, and moderation. For he was afraid lest by the punishment of this man he should hurt the feelings of Divitiacus. Therefore, before he attempted anything, he orders Divitiacus to be summoned to him, and when the ordinary interpreters had been withdrawn, converses with him through Caius Valerius Proculus, chief of the province of Gaul, an intimate friend of his, in whom he reposed the highest confidence in everything. At the same time, he reminds him of what was said about Dumnorix in the Council of the Gauls, when he himself was present, and shows what each has said of him privately in his, Kaiser's, own presence. He begs and exhorts him that without offense to his feelings, he may either himself pass judgment on him, Dumnorix, after trying the case, or else order the Aeduan state to do so. Chapter 20. Divitiacus, embracing Kaiser, begins to implore him with many tears that he would not pass any very severe sentence upon his brother, saying that he knows that those charges are true, and that nobody suffered more pain on that account than he himself did, for when he himself could effect a very great deal by his influence at home and in the rest of Gaul, and he, Dumnorix, very little on account of his youth, the latter had become powerful through his means, which power and strength he used not only to the lessening of his, Divitiacus's, popularity, but almost to his ruin. That he, however, was influenced both by fraternal affection and by public opinion. But if anything very severe from Kaiser should befall him, Dumnorix, no one should think that it had been done without his consent, since he himself held such a place in Kaiser's friendship. From which circumstance it would arise that the affections of the whole of Gaul would be estranged from him. As he was with tears begging these things of Kaiser in many words, Kaiser takes his right hand and, comforting him, begs him to make an end of entreating, and assures him that his regard for him is so great that he forgives both the injuries of the Republic and his private wrongs, and his desire and prayers. He summons Dumnorix to him. He brings in his brother. He points out what he censures in him. He lays before him what he of himself perceives and what the state complains of. He warns him for the future to avoid all grounds of suspicion. He says that he pardons the past for the sake of his brother Divitiacus. He sets spies over Dumnorix, that he may be able to know what he does and with whom he communicates. Chapter 21. Being on the same day informed by his scouts that the enemy had encamped at the foot of a mountain 8 miles from his own camp, he sent persons to ascertain what the nature of the mountain was, and of what kind the ascent on every side. Word was brought back that it was easy. During the third watch, he orders Titus Labienus, his lieutenant with praetorian powers, to ascend to the highest ridge of the mountain with 2 legions, and with those as guides who had examined the road. He explains what his plan is. He himself, during the fourth watch, hastens to them by the same route by which the enemy had gone, and sends on all the cavalry before him. Publius Considius, who was reputed to be very experienced in military affairs, and had been in the army of Lucius Sulla, and afterward in that of Marcus Crassus, is sent forward with the scouts. Chapter 22. At daybreak, when the summit of the mountain was in the possession of Titus Labienus, and he himself was not farther off than a mile and a half from the enemy's camp, nor, as he afterwards ascertained from the captives, had either his arrival or that of Labienus been discovered, Considius, with his horse at full gallop, comes up to him, says that the mountain which he, Caesar, wished should be seized by Labienus is in possession of the enemy, and that he has discovered this by the Gallic arms and ensigns. Caesar leads off his forces to the next hill, and draws them up in battle order. Labienus, as he had been ordered by Caesar not to come to an engagement unless Caesar's own forces were seen near the enemy's camp, that the attack upon the enemy might be made on every side at the same time, was, after having taken possession of the mountain, waiting for our men and refraining from battle. When at length the day was far advanced, Caesar learned through spies that the mountain was in possession of his own men, and that the Helvetii had moved their camp, and that Considius, struck with fear, had reported to him as seen that which he had not seen. On that day he follows the enemy at his usual distance, and pitches his camp 3 miles from theirs. Chapter 23. The next day, as there remained in all only 2 days' space to the time when he must serve out the corn to his army, and as he was not more than 18 miles from Bibracte, by far the largest and best-stored town of the Aedui, he thought that he ought to provide for a supply of corn, and diverted his march from the Helvetii, and advanced rapidly to Bibracte. This circumstance is reported to the enemy by some deserters from Lucius Aemilius, a captain of the Gallic horse. The Helvetii, either because they thought that the Romans, struck with terror, were retreating from them, the more so, as the day before, though they had seized on the higher grounds, they had not joined battle, or because they flattered themselves that they might be cut off from the provisions, altering their plan and changing their route, began to pursue and to annoy our men in the rear. Chapter 24. Caesar, when he observes this, draws off his forces to the next hill, and sent the cavalry to sustain the attack of the enemy. He himself, meanwhile, drew up on the middle of the hill a triple line of his 4 veteran legions, in such a manner that he placed above him on the very summit the 2 legions which he had recently levied in Hither Gaul, and all the auxiliaries, and he ordered that the whole mountain should be covered with men, and that meanwhile the baggage should be brought together into one place, and the position be protected by those who were posted in the upper line. The Helvetii, having followed with all their wagons, collected their baggage into one place. They themselves, after having repulsed our cavalry and formed a phalanx, advanced up to our front line in very close order. Chapter 25. Caesar, having removed out of sight first his own horse, then those of all, that he might make the danger of all equal, and do away with the hope of flight, after encouraging his men, joined the battle. His soldiers, hurling their javelins from the higher ground, easily broke the enemy's phalanx. That being dispersed, they made a charge on them with drawn swords. It was a great hindrance to the Gauls in fighting, that when several of their bucklers had been by one stroke of the Roman javelins pierced through and pinned fast together, as the point of the iron had bent itself, they could neither pluck it out, nor with their left hand entangled, fight with sufficient ease, so that many, after having long tossed their arm about, chose rather to cast away the buckler from their hand, and to fight with their person unprotected. At length, worn out with wounds, they began to give way, and as there was in the neighborhood a mountain about a mile off, to betake themselves thither. When the mountain had been gained and our men were advancing up, the Boii and Tulingi, who with about 15,000 men closed the enemy's line of march and served as a guard to their rear, having assailed our men on the exposed flank as they advanced, prepared to surround them. Upon seeing which the Helvetii, who had betaken themselves to the mountain, began to press on again and renew the battle. The Romans, having faced about, advanced to the attack in 2 divisions, the first and second line to withstand those who had been defeated and driven off the field, the third to receive those who were just arriving. Chapter 26. Thus was the contest long and vigorously carried on with doubtful success. When they could no longer withstand the attacks of our men, the one division, as they had begun to do, betook themselves to the mountain. The other repaired to their baggage and wagons. For during the whole of this battle, although the fight lasted from the seventh hour, i.e. 12 noon to 1 p.m., to eventide, no one could see an enemy with his back turned. The fight was carried on also at the baggage till late in the night, for they had set wagons in the way as a rampart, and from the higher ground kept throwing weapons upon our men as they came on, and some from between the wagons and the wheels kept darting their lances and javelins from beneath and wounding our men. After the fight had lasted some time, our men gained possession of their baggage and camp. There the daughter and one of the sons of Orgetorix were taken. After that battle, about 130,000 men of the enemy remained alive, who marched incessantly during the whole of that night, and after a march discontinued for no part of the night, arrived in the territories of the Lingones in the fourth day, whilst our men, having stopped for 3 days, both on account of the wounds of the soldiers and the burial of the slain, had not been able to follow them. Kaiser sent letters and messengers to the Lingones, with orders that they should not assist them with corn or with anything else, for that if they should assist them, he would regard them in the same light as the Helvetii. After the 3 days' interval, he began to follow them himself with all his forces. Chapter 27. The Helvetii, compelled by the want of everything, sent ambassadors to him about of surrender. When these had met him in the way and had thrown themselves at his feet, and speaking in suppliant tone, had with tears sued for peace, and when he had ordered them to await his arrival in the place where they then were, they obeyed his commands. When Kaiser arrived at that place, he demanded hostages, their arms, and the slaves who had deserted to them. Whilst those things are being sought for and got together, after a night's interval, about 6,000 men of that canton which is called the Verbigine, whether terrified by fear, lest after delivering up their arms they should suffer punishment, or else induced by the hope of safety, because they supposed that amid so vast a multitude of those who had surrendered themselves, their flight might either be concealed or entirely overlooked, having at nightfall departed out of the camp of the Helvetii, hastened to the Rhine and the territories of the Germans. Chapter 28. But when Kaiser discovered this, he commanded those through whose territories they had gone to seek them out and to bring them back again, if they meant to be acquitted before him, and considered them when brought back in the light of enemies. He admitted all the rest to a surrender, upon their delivering up the hostages, arms, and deserters. He ordered the Helvetii, the Tulingi, and the Latobrigi to return to their territories from which they had come, and as there was at home nothing whereby they might support their hunger, all the productions of the earth having been destroyed, he commanded the Allobroges to let them have a plentiful supply of corn, and ordered them to rebuild the towns and villages which they had burnt. This he did chiefly on this account, because he was unwilling that the country from which the Helvetii had departed should be untenanted, lest the Germans, who dwell on the other side of the Rhine, should, on account of the excellence of the lands, cross over from their own territories into those of the Helvetii, and become borderers upon the province of Gaul and the Allobroges. He granted the petition of the Aedui that they might settle the Boii in their own, i.e. in the Aeduan territories, as these were known to be of distinguished valor to whom they gave lands, and whom they afterwards admitted to the same state of rights and freedom as themselves. Chapter 29. In the camp of the Helvetii, lists were found, drawn up in Greek characters, and were brought to Kaiser, in which an estimate had been drawn up, name by name, the number from which had gone forth from their country, of those who were able to bear arms. And likewise the boys, the old men, and the women, separately. All of which items the total was, of the Helvetii, literally of the heads of the Helvetii, 263,000. Of the Tulingi, 36,000. Of the Latobrigi, 14,000. Of the Roraki, 23,000. Of the Boii, 32,000. The sum of all amounted to 368,000. Out of these, such as could bear arms amounted to about 92,000. When the census of those who returned home was taken, as Kaiser had commanded, the number was found to be 110,000. Chapter 30. When the war with the Helvetii was concluded, ambassadors from almost all parts of Gaul, the chiefs of states, assembled to congratulate Kaiser, saying that they were well aware that, although he had taken vengeance on the Helvetii in war for the old wrongs done by them to the Roman people, yet that circumstance had happened no less to the benefit of the land of Gaul than of the Roman people, because the Helvetii, while their affairs were most flourishing, had quitted their country with the design of making war upon the whole of Gaul, and seizing the government of it, and selecting, out of a great abundance, that spot for an abode which they should judge to be the most convenient and most productive of all Gaul, and hold the rest of the states as tributaries. They requested that they might be allowed to proclaim an assembly of the whole of Gaul for a particular day, and to do that with Kaiser's permission, stating that they had some things which, with the general consent, they wished to ask of him. This request having been granted, they appointed a day for the assembly, and ordained by an oath with each other that no one should disclose their deliberations except those to whom this office should be assigned by the General Assembly.